But it's lovely to be here, you know, meet you all. Because I'm here to part of this series of talking about different phases of the life of the Buddha. And the part I'm going to talk about this evening is, they call it the Parinirvana, the death of the Buddha. So I'm kind of aware that it, you know, we've had this theme of starting with the going forth. I don't know, I suppose not everybody's going to come every time, but they've got the going forth where the Buddha is a young man before he's enlightened, Gautama, Siddhartha. And the young man just trying to work out what to do, and he has his sights of realising, you know, old age, sickness and death, and he just goes, decides to just give up a kind of a life, a princely life, and just go forth and just search for the truth. And we had talk about, you know, the Buddha, as it were, attaining this enlightenment, as it were, where he really sees through. And then we had the example of Kisagotami, example of the teaching of the Buddha, where realizing that where a woman loses her child and realizes, you know, that in a way death is so common. So in a way, although I'm talking about the death of the Buddha now, in a way it's been a theme throughout. You know, we've got it at the very beginning. The Buddha sees it. Jimin sees somebody who's, well, sees old age, sickness, and death, and is looking for an answer for that. And and in a way, reaches something that seems to address that. And then, of course, with the Kosagotami story and many other stories, there's a thing of him communicating from that place of realizing, you know, this is what comes to us all. I'm going to just say a bit about the story of the Parinirvana. And then just say some stuff about it. It's often actually they say they have a day dedicated to this Parinirvana Day on the 15th of February, which I think is very close to Valentine's Day, the next day following romance comes. Actually, there's this picture. I was thinking I should try and find it last minute, but last minute scrambles aren't so good. But where there's a picture of the Buddha with Ananda, with his companion, just walking around the Indian countryside. These two then, and it's a really lovely picture of just two friends. You know, one's clearly older than the other, but these two friends just really enjoying talking to each other in this kind of golden light of India, and. In a way, the Buddha's Parinirvana the Buddha's with Ananda, just still travelling around India these times. Of course, with a heat, you know, heat that would be not dissimilar to what we've experienced recently. But he's wandering around, and there's been a whole thing of just, you know, lots of followers, monks and nuns. But this comes, and he's just wandering around at times with Ananda, who's very good at remembering what the Buddha's taught. There comes a point where the Buddha just realizes that he kind of knows that he's going to die, and he's 80 years old. He's just an old man. He's describing his body as just something that's sort of held together like an old hut, you know. And but he's just been traveling around, and he gets a sense that his death is coming, and he eats this meal which somebody gives him. In fact, he warns other people not to eat this meal, and then he just becomes very ill in his subsequent travels, and he's with Ananda, and he comes to a place called Kusinara, where he's like, no, this is it, you know, I'm going to die here, and he has it where he rests between two twin sala trees. I had to look on the Google. I thought I should look on Google what sala trees look like. Sala trees. But there he is lying beneath these trees in this place. Just a simple village, really, in India. Although the Buddha himself said, he did say that in a way, there'd been a great city there in the past. I suspect, you know, I don't think there's any records of that. But nonetheless, the sense of, even though he's just lying down to lie in this simple village, he's lying down, where he lies down, where the Buddha dies, is a place of great significance. The whole area is kind of full of mythic significance. It's kind of great, great occasion. And the monks and nuns are coming to the Buddha, you know, various lying trees. And the trees are they break into flower at the season. So this is just the images, really. There's the Buddha. He said this life of just again, enlightenment, but there's the thing of just teaching from that place, this place of just beauty and kindness and so on. And here is in the moment, you know, the universe responding, the trees just breaking into flower. And Ananda's, his companion, is he's just upset, really, because he, you know, he has a very deep friendship with the Buddha, and so he's, you know, he just goes off just being quite upset. And the Buddha says, where is Ananda? And calls him, and Ananda's been saying, well, my master, who is about to pass away, he who is so kind. And the Buddha calls Ananda to him to us and says, well, you know, have I not taught you that everything changes? Everything must pass. So, you know, and also in exhorting him to just practice more to gain enlightenment himself. But just have I not reminded you? And, you know, and the Buddha was actually, of course, just teaching to the end. There was somebody who came to him towards the end who just wanted to see him, and people were saying, come on, the Buddha's dying. But the Buddha's like, no. And he was just teaching him there. And teaching the monks as well, the monks and nuns who'd come to him. And the whole area, I'm not going to talk about this that much, anything, but they talk about the whole area being full of gods, like spirits and angels and things. At one point, one of the monks is attending to him, and he's like, no, you have to move out of the way. He's like, what? Middle of nowhere. It's like the whole area is just, there's so many gods here looking. Which, I mean, we can often sense that, don't you? There are times of significance in our lives, do you know what I mean? When everything is kind of imbued with something else, do you know? It's as though everything feels quite rich. And even we ourselves, in some ways, are there, you know, right now, just looking at the Buddha, just as he lies there. So this sense of just the whole area being full of rich significance, just witnessing this moment. And the Buddha, comes to the end, he gives his final exhortation to the monks, and he says, all conditioned things are impermanent, with mindfulness strive on. So all conditioned things are impermanent, with mindfulness strive on. And then he then goes into a range of meditative states, just rises up, sits down, and then he realizes, he's just passed away. And so in the state beneath the twin sala trees. And there's the whole thing being sort of full of mythic significance, the earth shakes, and you know, people are lamenting. But the people who are those who have gained enlightenment around her, they're not grieving, because they're also just in a way everything passes. And this is said to be the Buddha's kind of final release. There's a whole strand where the Buddha talks about how you can't say what happens to the Buddha after his death. You can't say, oh yeah, he carries on, this is what's going to happen. You can't say he doesn't carry on. It's just beyond, it's mystery. So that's the kind of some of what happened. It's actually quite a lot in the sutta, but I just sort of picked out some bits. In a way, I'm kind of aware that just talking about this whole area is just stepping into the kind of realm of impermanence. So this is the thing I really, really took from this. In fact, somebody said when I was at the camera, I said, what are you going to... I said, oh, my goodness, talk to the young people thing. And they said, what are you going to talk about? Is it that you're old? And I thought, in a way, yes, that's right. But not that I'm old, that everybody gets old. Do you know what I mean? Here we have the Buddha himself. Do you know what I mean? It happens. And I was thinking about this in terms of, say, the young people's Sangha thing. I remember me coming on to Bristol, do you know, when I was 22 or something, you know, just very early on, and just all the people I met there, or particular scenes. I just went to the Butterfield Festival, and you know, I was getting involved there when I was, you know, in my mid-20s, you know, 25 or so, just doing a lot there. Do you know, and you become aware of meeting particular people and particular times, and it's like this thing of impermanence. Everything, you've got this arising of things, and then things change. Do you know what I mean? And it's not lovely to come here actually and meet this particular arising, which will also change. You know, also become a memory. Also, of course, I'm aware that I'm stepping into the area of death in a way here with this. And at first, that was one thing that sort of drew me to be able to talk about, to choose this topic, because I thought, it's something that I sort of think about certainly daily in a way. Just this principle of that life is short in a certain kind of way, or one mustn't take for granted. It's just the fact of being alive. But then I realised when I was thinking about it, I thought, actually, what do I know? it's very easy for death, in relation to death, to think of some sort of fridge magnet slogans or whatever. And actually, it's quite, it's just something of that's just very, it's there for all of us. And yet, actually, in a way, I'm kind of, I don't know what the phrase is, out of my depth or something, or just aware that, it's very easy to think I know, but actually, I remember just simple things. Like I remember once trying to turn a nail with my bite, biting on it. You get to time to chip my tooth a tiny little bit. Do you know what I mean? You'd hardly notice. But just a minute ago, I was like, whoa, do you know what I mean? I don't like the fact that I chipped my tooth just a tiny little bit. And if that just wobbled me, just, do you know what I mean? Just the tiniest little thing, this whole big area. How am I with that, really? So I just don't really know, really. Sometimes it's very easy for me to, have an idea. But, I was aware, actually, I'd been on the year-long retreat, and I found it hard landing. Year-long retreats are quite intense things to come back from. I remember being at a retreat centre, and I was sort of struggling to sort of just settle and so on. And then I was talking to some person, and he revealed that he had some sort of long, some terminal illness and Parkinson's and things. It was a slow terminal illness, but nonetheless, he was referring to all this stuff. And he said, actually, and I'm fine with it, he said. And this is a sign of just how I'm very pleased that my practice has been going very well, that I'm fine with it. So he was really, that was a thing for him. But, for myself, who knows? So I sort of was aware, forgive me for talking about something that I don't know so much about. But of course, with the Buddha himself, in a way, he wasn't afraid of death. This wasn't a concern for him. And again, that's a mystery. What is it? What is it to get to that point where one is, one is just not afraid of death? In a way, that's quite a big ask. But in a way, there's this principle, and I remember it's in one of the books by Sangharakshita. I will die well because I have lived well. And there's something there about, in a way, the Buddha, having gained enlightenment, just devoted his whole life, as it were, to just living from that sort of deep meaning, whatever that comes with enlightenment. Just the thing of a life lived well. And that is something one can connect with. I was thinking, actually, there's a story of a Taoist master who, when his wife died, was just celebrating by banging pots and pans together. Because he was saying, in a way, the point of death, one can rejoice. Before one's done the thing, who can say how a life will be? But at the end, one can rejoice in what's there. And there's an element there of just being able to just rejoice in a life lived really well. But the thing for me that, certainly that I take from this thing of death, or in relation to in the spiritual life, is just this thing of the precious opportunity. When I first started going along to the Bristol Centre, there was an order member there called Manjushra, who actually wrote a few books, like The Poet's Way and a couple of books. And I remember him telling me that he'd been in a situation where he had a near-death experience when he was younger. I think he went through a car windscreen and survived. And this was, actually I read it, he told me about that, but I read in a book, he was saying that it was as though for a while everything was just so much more alive and full of colour. Do you know, it's really realising the preciousness of this. And I think that's the thing that, you know, I really, you know, so thinking about death, the thing of just realising that the life is just so precious, and yet so often I can just be just going through my sort of humdrum routine. And then there comes a point when people realise, when it could almost be lost or something, when they realise, oh, do you know what I mean? This is just a really precious opportunity, as it were, and everything can be just so alive at that moment. And for Manjusra, that really motivated him to get involved in the spiritual life, to just, as it were, be able to, realising that there was something important there, as it were, just being ready, as it were, for that when it comes again. In fact, he wrote a poem about an eagle, as it were, in the next room, that's just that he will meet again. You know, will he be ready? This thing of just, there are people thinking about this, that there are people out there who would pay us millions of pounds just for a minute of the life and health that we've got right now. Do you mean, at the drop of a moment, they'd be like, here's your £1 million. Do you mean just to be able to experience, do you mean just a minute of being alive in good health? This is another Buddhist quote, the human body pieced in itself is more precious than the rarest gem. Do you know, so this incredibly valuable opportunity, and yet we can, I take it for granted so often. And also we base our priorities also just in thinking that we're going to live forever. Actually, I was just doing some course related to my work, and there was some woman who, she had a lot of health difficulties. She nearly died when she was younger. I think she had sepsis and tuberculosis at the same time. And they didn't realise. And then after a couple of years, they did realise. And she got cured. But after that, she said she never got... You know what I mean? She just didn't get caught up with certain things, you know, like when certain things would happen in life. She would think, well, oh no, you know, this is bothering me. And she'd think, but does it really matter? No, it doesn't really matter. You know, because she'd had such a strong experience of just realising that just the priorities, and that's, I think, the value of just realising this thing of everything as it is impermanent. And a quote to go with this, we've got this is by Tsongkhapa, a Tibetan master. He says, this human life is precious, an opportunity to awaken, but this body is impermanent. One day I shall die, so this life I must know is a tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. This human life is precious. Yeah. As the tiny splash of a raindrop, a thing of beauty that disappears. So something about just whole, you know, just in some ways for me the thing of just thinking about death is just realising the kind of beauty, as it were, that just comes with this, as it were. Sometimes I think so you get these sort of meditations on impermanence and things, but the opposite of impermanence is, I sometimes think, is just our labels that we do things. You know how, I walk home, my walk home becomes my walk home. Do you know what I mean? Or, you know, my dinner just becomes my dinner, or a person becomes a person, or I'm just me. Do you know what I mean? In some ways, I'm just hanging this label around certain things I'm doing, and then I'm kind of a bit oblivious as I, you know, pour my food into my mouth. But actually, in some ways, the thing of just realising this, the sense of just, rather than having labels, we've got the fact that our experience is just, it's just very alive with movement and change. Do you know what I mean? It's got that sort of poignancy of, If you try and get hold of a thing and say, this is it, do you know what I mean? You've kind of lost it by the time you fix it. Actually, there's something about being alive to the impermanence of things, the kind of transient nature of things, which is just being alive to it, to the richness of what's actually there. So like when I'm you know, when I do have my walk home or whatever, do you know what I mean? Just realizing just how beautiful it is just to be walking by the river. Just this thing of just impermanence leading us to just the kind of beauty of the moment. And there are a couple of angles I was thinking of with this precious opportunity that we have. I mean, one is that we can, there's a thing that we can change. You know, this thing of impermanence, it allows us to, it's an opportunity. We can change. We can also change the world in the sense of, it's hard, isn't it, to change the world. But in a way, everything we're doing is influencing the world, even just at small levels. But the life is a blank canvas. You know, we can get a bit bridge magnety with it. But you know, the we can check and we can change. We can work on ourselves. So it's an opportunity. And you see this in the Buddha's life, just the example of a life lived well. I know also with people sometimes say about the question whether it was so realistic that people were actually not that, you know, were just sort of more stony faced when the Buddha died. But I was aware that when Sangharakshita, who set up this movement, when he died in was it late October, early November last year, he in a way there wasn't much in the way of sort of wailing and things, because in a way he was somebody who'd lived their life really well, do you know, and people could just rejoice in that, do you know what I mean, witnessing a life lived well. So you know, there's this thing of impermanence where we have the opportunity in a way to live our lives well. In a way, there's the thing of like thinking of it in relation to death, you know, on our deathbed, if we look back, what is it that we'd like to, you know, what is it we'd like to achieve with our lives? People say actually that this is, again, it's a sort of cliche thing, isn't it? But we wouldn't want to, we wouldn't be thinking, oh, if only I'd answer those emails at work. You know, if only I'd worked a bit longer and earned a bit more money. They don't tend to say that. You know, it's more about one's relationships with others and living a life one that's important to one, that's speaking from one's values, in a way taking more risks. So what is it, you know, what is it that we want with our lives? Well, I was thinking about this, and then I ran into a kind of difficulty, but just a sort of question in my myself when I was thinking about this, that I'm aware that in myself, I find it very easy to, when I think about life as this kind of precious opportunity where I can sort of, you know, one can achieve a lot and so on, or even change oneself in all sorts of ways, I realise that there's a danger that I can get into thinking, if only I could just push a bit harder, I could get somewhere else. Do you know? Like life is an opportunity to get somewhere else. And in myself, by too much Protestant work ethic, you know, there's a danger of just trying to get away, do you know what I mean, to some better, wonderful future in which everything is, everything's sorted because I've sort of worked hard to get there. And realising that actually, in a way, well, Buddhism talks about unsatisfactoriness. There is unsatisfactoriness in life. And realizing in some ways also that rather we can talk about the precious opportunities, the chance to change, but in some ways whatever happens, you've got the life you've got. Do you know? I've got the life I've got, we've each got the lives we want. We, you know, in terms of how we are in ourselves, how other people are. And it is easy for me to sometimes sort of think, oh, I want, you know, the precious opportunity, I kind of have an idea about, you know, how you get these YouTube videos of people doing things like they dive off cliffs with just very small little things that land to fly through the air and, you know, land skiing and things. You think, oh, there's life. Do you know what I mean? And then you look at your own life and you think, can I want my artist to go down to the co-op? But in a way, you've got the life you've got, and in a way, the thing of the precious, this is the precious opportunity of life. But realizing, if I'm saying about this thing of that people have their sort of, you know, sometimes their final moments, memories. My grandfather, he was dying, and I was just thinking, how would it have been in a hospital bed, just lying there, knowing, do you know what I mean, the precious moment of being alive, or even just looking back and thinking, really valuing the times of just being kind of healthy and just, you know, having, just being able to you know, so much the richness of life. You know, how much am I able to just appreciate the kind of richness of just this with all of its imperfections? As it were, I was talking about, I think, the soulfulness, you know, the thing of just how much is I'm able to, you know, even with one's own unsatisfactoriness, as it were, just be open with kindness to this. And in some ways, I have so many habits that are not about that. Do you know, well, I mean, like, there's one. Do you know, it's so easy, isn't it, to just, you know, to turn away from one's experience. Or even, there's one, do you know, in the sense that I can just get into my head very easily, because I just don't want to be with my experience often. Or the thing of being busy. Again, in our, you know, in our culture, you know, there's a strong, I say, I've got Protestant work ethic, me and a lot of people, you know, there's a thing of just constantly striving to be busy, almost as though there's this desire to achieve, you know, to make use of the opportunity. But actually, you know, there is talk somewhere of, you know, in a way, busyness being a form of laziness. We're kind of running away from the discomfort of actually being with our experience. And so often I see this as the case with Dharma practice, with Buddhist practice, is a thing of just being able to just be with what is here with kindness. You know, in a way, this opportunity to change, you know, in some ways, developing our ability to actually just be open to the richness of what is here right now. And I think it actually takes loads of work to do that. Do you know, I don't think it's easy. You know, you sort of think, oh, it's just sort of just be with what you've got right now. You think, oh, that's all right, then just do that. But actually, do you know, when I do that, even if sometimes I might do it, it just feels even like I'm just being stuck in my head in a certain kind of way with it. There's an element of actually being able to just sort of be embodied with what one has right now. And often I just see a lot of Buddhist practice is about that, just being able to... But I have the image I often use is of... a cauldron, which to hold my experience. Do you know which? So I don't think I want to just be with my experience. In some ways, I actually have to do quite a lot of, you know, meditation, or just allow myself space to just settle into myself, or just allow my heart, you know, just do what, you know, meditation or friendship, whatever, just to allow my heart to be an open enough, as it were, positive enough, that I can just be with what my experience is with kindness in an embodied way, you know, even if it's uncomfortable, and or even be with my experience, be open to others as well, you know, with whatever's going on for them as well, you know, with people we have, yeah, people have all sorts of things going on for them, but as it were, just being, you know, that working on oneself in a way where one has the kind of open-heartedness or the strength of heart or whatever to just to sort of receive people, do you know what I mean? Just as they are, without wanting something from them, do you know what I mean? Or just being able to just receive them as they are. So I was thinking about it in some ways that you got this, the thing of the precious opportunity is a chance to really, you could talk about the chance to change, but in some ways obviously the precious opportunity is just that chance to be able to develop the capacity to just be open to one's life as it is. And actually there'd be an awful lot of work in that. Remember, there's a lot of talk about, you know, since the 60s, probably forever, but about love, you know, isn't love wonderful? But I often think, you know, things like, say, the metta bhavana, you know, it's just a real opportunity to develop, you know, that capacity to just love, just hold with kindness what is here. And I think what a precious thing to have something that enables me, allows others to just open their hearts, such a valuable thing in life. But it's just, you know, it's how does one do it? It's just great to just make use of that opportunity. Oh, how long have I been speaking? Yeah. I said it should be about 10 past, I think. Okay, that gets me rough. Oh, yeah, of course, it's good in here. That's good, isn't it? 30 minutes and a half. And in a way, this quality of kindness is something that we we see, you know, bringing it back to the example of the Buddha's life story, that the whole, you know, here's somebody who's enlightened, you know, who's worked their whole life, you know, just following a thread of enlightenment in a way. Has done so much, and yet his final days are so much infused with kindness. You know, there's Ananda, his companion, just saying of all the things that Sangharakshita emphasizes this, but of all the things that Ananda has to say after decades of serving the Buddha is, he who is so kind. Do you know? So this thing of like when somebody's really in touch with reality, in touch with like just how the true nature of things, that kindness is what that looks like. You know, so somehow, in this thing of, I don't intellectually look at it, but I sort of feel it a bit more in the heart or something, this sense of like when you're in touch a bit more with like the true nature of things, the expression of that is kindness, really. And there's a quote here that is very much in keeping with that, which says, this is from the Dhammapada, so this is very early, you know, sort of classic teachings of the Buddha. But he says, others do not realise that we are all heading for death. Those who do realise it will compose their quarrels. So others do not realise that we are all heading for death. Those who do realise it will compose their quarrels. So in something of the fact of like that this is a, in a way, the, you know, let's say about say as we are here now, you know, it's an opportunity, if we come together like this, we'll be like this, just this one time only. Do you know what I mean? Next time will be something different and things change. So, you know, the sense of like actually what that calls forth is just something of kindness towards each other. Do you know what I mean? Just appreciating each other in this, rather than the kind of alienation that comes with ill will and so on. Just something about evoking love as the response to impermanence. And of course, we see the Buddha. You know, again, his friendship with Ananda. He just rejoices in Ananda. He's you know, just reaching out, helping others. And there's just so much love for the Buddha as well. And I think that's one of the things I think of just life generally is so much about just I think it must be in everybody this desire to just love and be loved. Do you know what I mean? This sense of just like that sense of just we want to live on that. We are relational beings. We want to live on that basis, and something about it links in with impermanence in terms of just appreciating every opportunity. There are connections. Something about just to realise death, to realise impermanence is to invite kindness. So, perhaps that's. I'll. I'm going to bring in a little poem just before I end it. I was writing down all these poems and writing them up here. There's the. And we'll do the Shakespeare one. That's one if we're in the theatre, the Prospero one. Do you know that one? It's a bit of how does it go? We are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little life is rounded with sleep. I thought I'd have to read the whole quote out if we're in the theatre. It's hundreds of years of history. But Manjushra, who I was talking about, I was looking at his poem about the eagle, but there's another one where he just says, writing poetry at Edinburgh Airport. Just said, Li Po said, to read poetry is to be alive twice. At the airport, it is easier to see how everyone is equal. There is only one human story. It ends in leaving. So this thing of just appreciating every moment, and maybe this thing of life being linked with a poetic way of seeing things. But it, you know, it comes down at the end to that the Buddha done these things, and Ananda saying, "He who was so kind to me," and the twin salar trees just breaking into untimely blossom. That just falls to the Buddha. Yeah. parinirvana. I'll turn this off.